Welcome to the political scene. I'm Susan Glasser. This week, Liz Truss became the United Kingdom's newest prime minister. Truss comes into office following a string of scandals in the Conservative Party under her predecessor, Boris Johnson, and inherits a nation in the midst of a bleak economic forecast, including talk of recession and a crisis in energy prices. And while she has proven popular with the Conservative Party's most loyal members, that certainly does not ensure success for the new prime minister with the wider British public. I'm joined today by my colleague Sam Knight, who is based in London for The New Yorker and has been closely following the latest tumult in British politics. Sam, thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you for having me, Susan. It's a real pleasure.
Well, I'm delighted in part because I think, you know, here we are in the United States wondering what to think. It really seems like Britain is in a crisis mode right now. Liz Truss is not inheriting a country in good shape from Boris Johnson.
No, it's very, very true. You know, I do feel that what is happening in the UK right now is a pretty extreme version of what is possible in a parliamentary democracy, if you know what I mean. Not to sort of get too straight into the sort of the constitutional weeds of this, but this is the fourth Conservative administration in this country since 2010. So, you know, in the last sort of 12 years, we've had a single party leading the government, you know, for the first 5 years in a coalition, and since then they've been governing alone, renewing itself after scandals, after Brexit, and in a sense, hollowing itself out. You know, there's just a practical nature of this. You have a certain number of members of parliament, all of whom have to be elected to serve in the, as a minister or as a cabinet minister, or as a prime minister. The Conservatives are continuing to hold on to power long after maybe they've kind of have the right to still hold it, but they're continuing to refresh themselves, to subtly change their political messaging, to change the platform on which they're standing. And now we're in the next phase.
Well, that's right. Let's talk a little bit about Liz Truss. You know, whether she is a representative of a late stage Toryism or not, she's not all that well known here across the pond. What do we need to know about Liz Truss?
So Liz Truss is an impressive political survivor, and she is an impressive minister. You know, the British system has this, again, this kind of comes back to the parliamentary democracy thing. People get moved from department to department. So, you know, you run the education department for a couple of years, you run the health system for a couple of years, and you move from post to post. And she has been doing that since 2012. So she's actually been at the top table of British politics for a decade. I'm not going to say kind of going under the radar. You know, if you follow British politics, you've been aware of Liz Truss for a good long time. And the fact that she has a reputation for being effective in those jobs that she holds and being popular among the party's traditional base. And when I say traditional base, you know, low tax, law and order, old-fashioned conservative. She's always been someone who's talked about as a potential leader of the party one day. She's not come from nowhere. And a rather remarkable thing is that today she ran her first cabinet meeting as prime minister, and she was the only person sitting around that table who was also sitting around the table in David Cameron's government 7 years ago.
Yeah, no, it's that the tumult in British politics is fairly remarkable, and also her own evolution. I mean, she, in fact, wasn't always even a member of the Conservative Party. She started out as a Liberal Democrat, ended up as a Conservative. She was anti-monarchist. Now she's pro. She was most famously anti-Brexit back during the Brexit referendum, and now is not only pro, but is a real hardliner. So what does it mean to have someone who's so willing to adjust her core positions?
Well, I will shamelessly use her French nickname, which is the Iron Weather Vane, which is a kind of beautiful bit of political kind of commentary. On the one hand, it's responding to her overt desire to be considered a political descendant of Margaret Thatcher, the Iron Lady. And on the other hand, this weather vane expression refers to what you've been talking about, which is her supreme adaptability. I think that, you know, yes, you can do a pretty good rap sheet of Liz Truss seeming to change her mind about things. And obviously Brexit is kind of wheeled out as the main one here. I think context is really important here. You know, if you go back to the Brexit vote in 2016, it was around 75% of members of parliament opposed Brexit. It was a very radical policy position, only at that time held by the right wing of the Conservative Party. It's not unusual for Conservative politicians to have changed their minds or shifted their rationale around that decision. I actually think there's a much longer degree of continuity to Liz Truss's thinking. Particularly, people talk about a book that she helped co-author in 2012 called Britannia Unchained, which is a pretty red-blooded call for a very familiar conservative platform of cutting regulations, cutting workers' protections, lowering taxes, boosting productivity through basically, you know, every pro-business measure that you can think of. And that's been right there. That's where she stands politically.
You know, it's very interesting that she even ended up in the job, right? I mean, this fall from grace, if you will. I'm not sure there was ever grace associated with Boris Johnson, but whatever you want to call it, you know, scandal after scandal after scandal, which finally earlier this summer forced the resignation of Boris Johnson. And yet it seems that in part, Liz Truss was chosen by the party faithful because she was seen as more the inheritor of Johnson's party than those who were seen as betraying him. This is not a general election that produced this new prime minister of Britain, but just a small number of, I think, something under 200,000 members of the Conservative Party. And so she's leaned potentially even farther right in the effort to inherit Johnson's mandate. What does that tell us about her and how she'll govern?
I think that probably the short answer to that question is that there has been one issue overhanging the Conservative Party leadership contest that you described there, and that is kind of what were the two candidates offering in the face of the very, very difficult economic situation that the UK faces, partly driven by inflation, aggravated by the war in the Ukraine, and arguably aggravated by Brexit as well. And the way that this is kind of manifesting most worryingly for the British population is like unbelievable increases in their energy bills. And so the kind of the single question that overhung the contest this summer was like, okay, what are you doing about energy prices? And Liz Truss held out, you know, almost with kind of robotic steeliness, kind of refusing to say that she was going to do anything, which is sort of an unthinkable position for most middle-class families in the UK. But, you know, as you referred to it, went down fine with the Conservative Party base. But now, you know, now that she's safely in Downing Street, oh, you know, pretty much the night before she was confirmed as leader, we started to see details of her plan, which is, you know, an enormous state bailout of energy companies, which will freeze prices for consumers and guarantee about $250 billion of payments to energy companies over the next 10 to 20 years, a huge tax-funded bailout of energy companies in order to get her through this first couple of winters as prime minister. So that's, you know, how's she going to govern? She's going to parade her principles and then do whatever's necessary to try and get the opinion polls turning around a bit.
So I saw a headline in the Daily Mirror today that sort of sums up the situation she finds herself in. It was a picture of her and it said, now fix the Britain you lot broke. So did Boris Johnson break Britain?
I mean, Boris Johnson did terrible damage to the way that politics is conducted in this country. And he kind of still doesn't really get it. I mean, even, you know, in his resignation speech on the steps of Downing Street, he was kind of complaining about how the kind of the rules had been changed halfway through his premiership and sort of offering these kind of oblique hints, sort of referring to a Roman senator, Cincinnatus, about, you know, how he might, you know, make his political comeback one day. Boris Johnson did terrible damage, both when he was sort of, in inverted commas, behaving himself when he successfully concluded the Brexit negotiations and the UK's departure from the European Union by dissolving Parliament, by taking kind of a wrecking ball to the Constitution and getting in trouble with the Supreme Court and kind of generally showing a kind of an unbelievable remorselessness with how he conducted his politics. And then the kind of the second act of the Johnson premiership was the pandemic. And in that he acted poorly, both on a kind of political decision-making basis, and then ultimately kind of on a poor kind of moral basis by the way that he and the officials and people working in Downing Street conducted themselves during the pandemic, which ultimately brought to his downfall. So yeah, his sins are many.
You know, he came to office promising to be the prime minister who would get Brexit done. Is that in the end what he'll be remembered for, or is it more the sort of buffoonish last act, or, you know, potentially last act during COVID, and that just the scandals and the sort of petty, as you said, demoralizing of British politics?
Yeah, it's a really interesting question. And I think that, annoyingly, sorry, I think it's too soon to say, and I think it's why he leaves office with this feeling of unfinished business, which was like, how far did this scandal truly spread beyond Westminster and the desperate interest of people who kind of follow these things closely? How much did it really kind of bother ordinary voters? And I think he still feels like the jury is out. And to be honest, I kind of do too. I feel like, you know, the popularity of his government has really started to fall off a cliff this year as people have just become terrified about their finances. And that, you know, that happens to any administration, doesn't it? When the economy really turns and, you know, inflation hits 10% and the Bank of England is forecasting a recession that'll last more than a year, and you're looking at energy bills that are simply unaffordable, then you want to get rid of whoever's in power, whoever they are. And so I think that, you know, we'll have an election in 2024 and it'll be much clearer then. I mean, I just one last thing to say is that what I find a curious facet of Johnson's popularity is that he's never really suffered politically for his kind of operational conduct during the pandemic. You know, tens of thousands of people unnecessarily died in the UK because of the way that he delayed and made poor decisions. And it was obviously a horrible situation for leaders across the world, but his government did very badly. And they never really suffered politically for that. There was enormous general sympathy for Johnson for having caught the virus, the sense that he'd done his best and he'd been a bit out of his depth. Do you know what I mean? He is a remarkable politician in terms of what stuck to him and what didn't stick.
Well, that's right. He had a sort of Trumpian ability to get in trouble and somehow not face the consequences until the moment he did, which arguably was a consequence of the difference in the political systems between the United States and the UK. You know, if there was a parliamentary system, it would have probably been much easier at various points to oust Donald Trump than it proved to be.
Yeah, and the Conservatives this spring going into summer had, the members of Parliament anyway, had a kind of gut feeling that they couldn't defend this guy on the campaign trail anymore. And it was just a collective decision to ditch him. He was a drag. And, you know, in his political career up until that moment, his appeal, like other, you know, successful and popular politicians, was that he could bring in voters from beyond the party. And then there was just that sense that he was no longer that person. His behavior was indefensible along, you know, on any kind of rational basis. But I think politically it'll be unclear whether that was the right call because, you know, Liz Truss is a much less effective performer. You know, if you ever hear her speak, it's kind of heavily scripted, these kind of staccato sentences that wait for the applause. You know, it's pretty tough going.
Hi, it's David Remnick. If you're enjoying this podcast, you might enjoy even more of what The New Yorker has to offer. Becoming a subscriber gives you unlimited access to The New Yorker, including Pulitzer Prize-winning reporting, insightful cultural commentary, and fiction and poetry. You'll also enjoy our delightful cartoons, crossword puzzles, narrated stories, and much more. This past year, our readers were gripped by Ronan Farrow's profile of Elon Musk, Heidi Blake's extraordinary tale about Dubai's runaway princesses, and much more. Visit NewYorker.com to gain access to all this and more. Use the code POD15, P-O-D-1-5, to secure a 15% discount on a yearly digital subscription. That's POD15 for a 15% discount.
So let's talk about Liz Truss, not only as a politician, but the situation that she inherits. It's a mess. It's broken. Its economy is in big trouble, and particularly energy seems to be the real fear looking ahead toward winter because of Russia's war in Ukraine. You're talking about gas prices that could be, not just double, right, for ordinary households in Britain. You're talking about people literally potentially not being able to afford heat this winter. Is that right?
Yeah, no question. For the last few years, the UK has had a system whereby energy prices are regulated to prevent kind of blatant profiteering by energy companies. So an independent regulator sets a maximum retail energy price, but it's just to kind of stop obvious bad practice. It just tracks the market price. And, the market price of gas in particular, natural gas, which is how most British people heat their homes, has quadrupled on energy markets in the last year. And therefore, your gas bill, my gas bill, will go up from about £100 a month for, a three-bedroom house to about £480. So yeah, nearly five times if there wasn't any government intervention. And for many families, you just can't find an extra $4,000 or $5,000 a year of income here to heat your homes. It's not there. It doesn't exist. And so that presents a choice for Truss on the scale of the financial crisis in 2007-08 or the early months of the pandemic. We're talking that scale of intervention being required to stop households experiencing real suffering this winter and businesses going bankrupt.
Well, you wrote, actually, I think you anticipated this inevitable pivot of hers a few weeks ago when you said that Truss's record suggests she will switch to the safest political ground once she enters Downing Street. This plan to basically protect households somewhat from skyrocketing energy costs seems to be her pivoting to safer political ground. So is that going to work in your view? And will she have any trouble getting it through Parliament?
I think it probably will work. Again, if you could just try and take a step back and consider this, somewhat crudely, millions of British people are like, oh, phew, I'm going to be okay. And, that breathes a lot of sympathy into the system. Is it going to work politically in the sense of getting it through Parliament and kind of withstand the scrutiny of everyone watching her, making her kind of first moves as Prime Minister? I think that's a much more complicated question. The Labour version of this policy is more or less to do the same thing, freeze energy prices, but fund it through a windfall tax on oil and gas companies, which is obviously hugely popular. There are huge profits going somewhere and there's, no reason not to lay a claim to them. And she's saying she isn't going to do that. She's just going to fund this through overall taxation over the next 10 years. I think that's quite a complicated sell, particularly to the Conservative Party, who've been craving someone who's going to cut taxes and, let the economy roar again. So I think this is going to be an unbelievably challenging first couple of months for her. But she's done, in a sense, the only thing that she could do for the population as a whole, on your first day in the job, is to throw everyone a lifeline for the next 6 months. But I mean, Labour's 10, 15 points ahead in the polls at the moment. I think most of that is just due to people's economic anxiety. That's the hill that she has to climb.
Well, it is quite a flip-flop, even in a public, and the British public certainly, just as with the American, is used to politicians who flip-flop to do it on day one. In fact, she had said, I believe on the campaign trail, that she was planning to cut taxes on day one, and instead on day one, she has done, as you said, pretty much the only thing she could do, which is not only to not cut taxes, but to engage in the kind of what she derided as, I think, handouts when she was campaigning.
Yeah. And well, the obvious charge against her is that, you know, the handout is going to already immensely profitable energy companies. That's where the handout is going. Yeah, it's a very, very difficult situation. But I think that for the Conservative Party, at least, they will be breathing a real sigh of relief that this is an effective person who, you know, while she has this adaptability tendency to flip-flop, she's not someone who carries any whiff of scandal or impropriety about her. She doesn't really make mistakes. And I think there'll be a sense of kind of some kind of ordinariness returning to politics. I think what was so terrifying about Johnson as the prime minister, if you were a conservative politician, is you genuinely didn't know what was going to happen next. And Truss isn't like that.
Yeah, the Boris show is, if not over, at least temporarily canceled. Now, in her most recent job before she became prime minister, she was a foreign minister. And I thought it was very interesting that one of her first moves as prime minister was to meet with Olaf Scholz, the German chancellor, to discuss this energy crisis that both Germany and the UK face, in part because they had refused over many, many years to wean themselves from Russian energy, despite Putin's aggressive moves over the years, which certainly did not start with the invasion of Ukraine in February, right? And so what, if anything, do you glean from her time as foreign minister? Do you think, you know, I mean, Boris had lots of Hail Britannia, we're going to still be a power on the world stage kind of rhetoric. It went over super well with the Ukrainians. He was probably more popular in Kyiv when he left than he was in London. Is she going to be that kind of a sort of Britain is still a world player leader?
Yes, I think so. I mean, I think... So as foreign secretary, she was very involved in Ukraine policy, and she's obviously associated herself incredibly closely with that because it's popular here as well. And she, you know, describes herself as, you know, someone who took on Putin, whatever that, you know, exactly means. And so she's definitely sort of draping herself in the Union Jack in exactly the same way. You know, something that caught a lot of attention here last year was when she organized to have herself photographed on top of a tank, I think during some NATO military exercises in Estonia, which is, if you're a British political junkie, only recalls, you know, one other photo, which is a photo of Margaret Thatcher doing exactly the same thing. So she's definitely reaching for that mantle, and did as foreign secretary. And it was obviously partly her positioning herself as a future leader of the party. I think she, just her demeanor is pretty tough, kind of whoever she's dealing with. So she's sort of promised, you know, tougher relations on China. She's obviously a kind of keen Brexiteer now, and sort of portrays herself as someone who sort of won't take any nonsense from the European Union either. I mean, I think, you know, at some point you have to be friends with somebody. So I don't know whether she can sort of carry that indefinitely. But as, you know, as foreign secretary, she was definitely kind of hawkish in a way that's in a way more kind of plausible than Johnson, because, you know, obviously part of Johnson's appeal was that he was somewhat lovable, almost despite yourself. He has a warmth, and she's more reserved than that.
Well, you mentioned Margaret Thatcher. Of course, you know, Thatcher casts a long shadow over any female politician in the United Kingdom. It's interesting that Liz Truss is now the third female prime minister, Thatcher being the first, Theresa May most recently being one of her predecessors before Johnson, struggling again and again with this sort of post-Brexit crisis on what to do with the European Union. So how do you assess, why is it that over there you've managed to have three female prime ministers and, you know, in the United States, it's literally seen as impossible for a woman to become president?
It's a really interesting question, isn't it? And the Conservative Party is, you know, extremely pleased with itself, as it should be, for having its third female prime minister. I think in a way, kind of comes back to something I said right at the top of the program about, you know, a parliamentary democracy and the fact that Liz Truss might not be uniformly popular. And it's genuinely very difficult to sort of to imagine what her premiership is going to be like. But, you know, she's been at the top table of British politics for the last 10 years, and she has gained the trust and respect of her peers for her, you know, for her professionalism and her competence and her skill. And I wonder in other political systems whether female politicians or female candidates just don't even get a chance to do a version of the job. And maybe some of the quirks of how we elect prime ministers, you know, it's easy to deride the anti-democratic nature of the Conservative Party election process, but that's how Margaret Thatcher, Theresa May and Liz Truss all became the leaders of their party. Margaret Thatcher, obviously, incredibly successful election-winning politician. Theresa May, slightly less so. Liz Truss, untested before the population as a whole. So I wonder whether some of those kind of those quirks of the selection process allow these things to happen.
Well, Sam, I think we'll have plenty of time to ponder that over the next few years. And, you know, maybe the answer is even simpler than that, which is just that Britain hands all its really tough jobs to women. And right now, there's a pretty big crisis in the UK, and she's not going to have an easy time of it, that's for sure. But I want to thank you for your fantastic letters from the UK for The New Yorker, and we're really grateful to you to helping us understand what's going on over there.
Yeah, thank you very much for having me.
Sam Knight is a New Yorker staff writer based in London and the author of The Premonitions Bureau. This has been The Political Scene. Our theme music is by Russell Gillespie. The show is produced by Michelle Moses and Kylie Warner. Kylie, I should say, has been a force behind The Political Scene for many years, and this is her last episode. We're so grateful for all she's done for the show, and we can't thank her enough. All the best, Kylie, and thank you again. I'm Susan Glasser. Thanks so much for listening.